Hi, hello, and welcome to the 90s podcast, an aviation podcast. Today's episode special guest is Vincent Jello Aiello. He's a former F-18, F-16 U.S. Navy fighter pilot. He's currently flying as a commercial pilot for a major career in North America. He's as well the host of the Fighter Pilot podcast. Here is a quick highlight of this episode.
Oh, in 1997, we went straight over, and this was when President Clinton was in office. And I remember one night we had just pulled out of a port visit from Haifa, Israel, and the news on the ship's TV was talking about the president had just ordered the aircraft carrier that I was on to the Persian Gulf. And sure enough, within 5 minutes, the ship's captain came on with his whistle and we all said, uh-oh, here it comes. And he says, all right, our orders have changed. We're going to go through the Suez Canal and go to the Persian Gulf. And we ended up spending, I think, the next 5 months out of a six-month deployment in the Persian Gulf.
And now, without any further ado, Jello. Hi, Jello. Thank you for joining me on the 90s podcast.
You're welcome, Matt. It's good to be here.
How are you today? How is California going on?
Oh, I'm looking out at a sunshiny day and blue skies. Been really nice. We're starting to have some freedoms back after the worldwide pandemic. So we've been out and about a little bit, but still just coming off the back end of that whole issue.
Yeah, hopefully it will bounce back very quickly in a few weeks from now. You're from California initially?
Yes, I was born in Southern California, spent my first 9 years there, and then raised on the Central Coast of California.
Central Coast. Okay. And how did you get into aviation?
Well, my stepfather arrived in the family and took us to air shows in the late 1970s, and I was just smitten. I saw the airplanes and the noise and the pilots and everything about it, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. And I think a lot of kids probably have that same reaction, but for me, it stuck with me. And as I was in high school, my stepfather again said, what are you going to do with your life? And I said, well, I'm not really sure. He said, maybe you should try to be a fighter pilot. And from then on, I made it my effort to do it and was lucky enough to make it.
So you've chosen to be a fighter pilot. Did you choose the career path or the under contract officer path?
Well, so I looked at the Navy and I was not accepted to the Navy Academy. It just didn't have the good enough scores, I guess. And so I was enrolled in what's called Reserve Officer Training Corps, where you go through some military training while you're in a civilian college. And at the end of that, I was commissioned as an officer.
Okay. How long do you plan to do your career in the Navy?
Well, I thought I would go as long as I was still having fun. And that ended up being almost 25 years.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of fun during those 25 years. Did you fly directly the F-18?
Yes. After flight school, where I flew three different aircraft types, I was assigned the F-18 and flew that almost exclusively until my next to last tour, where I had a chance to also fly the F-16 Fighting Falcon or Viper at the Navy base just east of Reno in Nevada, where they have some adversaries or aggressors. And I was able to do that for about 170 hours of experience. And that was a lot of fun too.
Yeah, flying the F-16 for the Navy, it's pretty exotic. We don't think about it. And we can't imagine that you have your own aggressor squadron flying the F-16.
No, you're right about that, Mateo. In fact, sometimes I post videos or photographs of F-16s on my various social media platforms. And I will say, oh, this was a Navy F-16. And there's always someone who says, you're so dumb. There's no Navy F-16s. They're all Air Force. And I always try to, as politely as possible, correct them from their error. But yes, the Navy does have 14 F-16s, 10 single seat and 4 two seats. And they're all right there at that one base.
Yeah. So you fly only aggressor missions.
Correct. We don't do any air-to-ground missions. We don't aerial refuel. We don't do any what we would call blue air missions, just the red air.
Yeah. Back up in your F-18 time, so I think you were deployed a lot during cruise missions. When was your first operation?
My first deployment left in the fall of 1997 and returned in the spring of 98. And that was the first of 5 aircraft carrier deployments. And then I did a 6th deployment on the ground in Afghanistan, but I was not in a flying capacity at that time.
When was your first, let's say, war operational deployment?
Oh, in 1997, we went straight over, and this was when President Clinton was in office. And I remember one night we had just pulled out of a port visit from Haifa, Israel, and the news on the ship's TV was talking about the president had just ordered the aircraft carrier that I was on to the Persian Gulf. And sure enough, within 5 minutes, the ship's captain came on with his whistle and came on there. And we all said, uh-oh, here it comes. And he says, all right, our orders have changed. We're going to go through the Suez Canal and go to the Persian Gulf. And we ended up spending, I think, the next 5 months out of a 6 month deployment in the Persian Gulf, going back and forth to missions over Iraq and also pulling into port in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And we flew, at that time, it was Operation Southern Watch.
What were the kind of mission you were flying at that time? Air-to-air missions, air-to-ground missions, or a mix of those?
Mostly air-to-air for that first deployment. We
Very
were
fun.
Well, except nothing ever happened. But we were patrolling a segment, and they would have you in a lane, if you will. They would divide up the southern portion of Iraq into different columns, let's call it, and they would put aircraft in different columns, and you would cap north and south and just listen. And it was very easy to get complacent, frankly, because very rarely did any aircraft head south and challenge us. But that did happen actually in early 1999, but it was not during my deployment.
You didn't have any Kermit at all?
No, I frankly don't even remember any evidence of aircraft airborne in the areas they were allowed to, north of the no-fly zone. So it was pretty uneventful.
Okay, it was only defensive missions. You didn't do any offensive OCA missions?
No, not at that time. This was, again, as long as Iraq followed the United Nations mandates, then they were allowed to fly in their regular areas. I forget the parallels, maybe north of the 33rd or 34th and south of the 36th, I want to say. I could be wrong about that. But as long as they stayed in their allowed area, then we weren't permitted to go rough people up, if you will. We were just said, hey, you hang out here in case they come south. And at that time, they never did.
Yeah. When was your first, let's say, air-to-ground deployment going to strike during a conflict?
Well, it was that, in fact, the very next deployment in the very same squadron, and we left in the fall of 1999. We spent the year 2K, if you remember that big deal with all the worries about whether computers would survive the New Year's Eve turning into 2000. But yeah, we spent that underway. And then I actually left the ship early for my next set of orders to Top Gun, but the rest of the ship pulled back in the spring of 2000. And on that deployment, by then, just a couple of years later, the Iraqis had become a little bit more belligerent, if I may say. Mm-hmm. And so we began carrying air-to-surface weapons. And in fact, on December, I think it was 5th of 1999, I did employ a 500-pound laser-guided weapon on a anti-aircraft artillery gun that was firing at my flight.
It was kind of, it was not pet shot, it was a reactive shot at the time.
Right. It was somewhat similar to before, where we would carry weapons just in case. And if they instigated something, then we could retaliate. And for the most part, we weren't doing anything to provoke them. But on this particular day, we were flying in the area, at least according to the United Nations, that we were permitted to fly. But the Iraqis, again, were becoming just a little more belligerent, I guess is the best word. But they were firing at us. And so we were given permission by higher headquarters to attack the site that was firing at us.
And when was your last deployment, personal deployment? I think before flying the F-16, obviously.
Yes, it was. So in 2009, I was the air wing operations officer for the forward deployed air wing in Japan. And we performed a deployment mostly in the Western Pacific around north of Australia, Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean, in that vicinity.
So you came back from the Iraq War. I had Matt Hull during my last episode, and we talked a lot about PTSDs and all that stuff. Did you encounter any PTSD yourself?
No, I did not. I would say the most traumatic experience I had was actually not having to do with combat, but was trying to land on the aircraft carrier one particular night off the coast of Matt Hall's country there, Australia. We had some rather rough seas that were heaving the ship quite a bit. Plus it was nighttime. And so we had quite an event to get all the aircraft recovered safely aboard. And in fact, all this was chronicled in a 2008 PBS documentary multi-part series called Carrier. And there was one particular segment called, I forget what it was called, but I have a brief speaking part in that where I was explaining why it was so difficult to land. And it was, that was quite harrowing. I would say that was far more harrowing than anything else I experienced over Iraq or elsewhere.
So you retired in 2017, then you transitioned to the commercial aviation. This is a complete different life and complete different job. How did you prepare to proceed to the interviews, to the assessments? I think you've done, I don't know how many assessments you've done, but we need a specific preparation to do those assessments. So how did you prepare yourself?
Well, I was fortunate to be part of a group of fellow naval aviators who help each other acquire airline jobs. And I was able to look and learn and listen from that group as they bantered back and forth. And it was just a function of trying to decide what I wanted to do. Because at first, believe it or not, I did not want to be an airline pilot. I frankly thought I wanted to do something else. But as fewer options became available to me and nothing really struck my attention, I realized I needed to put food on the table. I have three sons and they eat quite a bit. So I just kept dipping a toe, if you will, in the pool of being an airline pilot. And I thought, I'm sure I can do this. This is maybe the one part of my life where I was very confident and arrogant to a point. I said, I'm sure I could do this. So let me just put in an application and see if they'll take me. And sure enough, I was asked for an interview. And the very first company I interviewed with, I was offered a job and accepted it. And I prepared by simply thinking back through my experiences and coming up with examples where if they ask me certain questions in the interview, let's say, that I would know that, oh yeah, there was this one time when I did this, and this was the two choices. And so we chose this, and this was the result, and this is what I learned. And so there are just strategies that are useful. You can take your own personal experiences, distill them into what you did, what your choices were, and what you learned from it. And I think that's what the interviewers were looking for. So between the interview and the application and all the qualifications, I just learned from others best I could and just tried to take one day at a time. And I was fortunate to be offered a position.
Yeah, great. So did you have all your qualifications before, or did you have to take and pass those exams?
Well, so in the States here, you need what's called an ATP, Airline Transport Pilot Certification. And I was able to acquire that in the fall of 2016 prior to retiring. Again, just kind of seeing the writing on the wall for I better get something lined up. And so I submitted, I want to say, my applications in November of 2016. I had my retirement ceremony at the end of December over the holidays when guests were in town, family. And then in early 2018, January of that year, I was offered the interview, went in February, was offered the job, and then went to start in May. So everything worked out quite well for my second career.
Starting in May, can you just tell us about your new job? What's your new job compared to the X1?
Sure. So the first thing I did was go to 2 weeks of indoctrination at the airline's headquarters. And that's where you learn how to walk and talk like someone from that company. You find out what's important to them. They give you background on compensation and leave and sickness, if you have to take any time off for that. Mm-hmm. All the different technicalities of being employed. Of course, you fill out all the paperwork and background checks and all that. And so after those 2 weeks, they provided me some self-study. So I came home for about a month and I was receiving some very basic pay at that point. And then I returned in, I want to say early June, to begin my month of training. And at this time I was flying the Boeing 717. It's like a DC-9, if people are familiar with the twin engines on the back. Mm-hmm. And I basically had to go for a couple of days of academics in classrooms, and then you have procedure trainers in a very basic rudimentary simulator, and then it's a crawl, walk, run type of lockstep process over the next month until at the end you are flying alongside in a simulator, of course, with another pilot. And you are doing all the correct procedures the way the company wants you to do it, the way the Federal Aviation Administration wants you to do it. And then if you pass your check ride, which I did without too much trouble, then they give you the certification. Mm-hmm. And then since you're new to the airlines, the first thing they want you to do is sit on the jump seat and go observe another real captain and first officer go do a rotation. And at first it's interesting because you can put to your mind's eye there all the things that you learned in your training and say, okay, that's what they really do. And that's what this means. And it really sinks it all in. But by about the third or fourth leg of that couple day trip, I thought, all right, let me have at it because I think I've got this figured out. And then a few days later, I went for my very first trip. And I guess that was the one big thing that was different is in the military, of course, you have very basic flights to begin with. But my very first flight in a 717, there were paying passengers inside. And of course, by then, the company and the FAA and everybody else thought I was okay. And sure enough, it went by with no problem. And plus, you have another pilot there next to you. So really not a big deal.
Yeah. So what's your specific roster now, your schedule?
Now I'm on a different airplane. I fly the 757 and the 767. You can fly both. And those are also Boeing products. And because of the virus issues and the world's sudden changes, I have been what's called on reserve, where you are effectively, to use a baseball analogy, in the dugout, waiting to be called if they need a new pitcher. And then you have certain days where you're available. And if they need you, they call you and you go. And if they don't, they don't call you and you stay home and you still get paid a certain number of hours, whether they use you or not. And so for the whole month of April and so far in May, they have not needed me to fly. So that's actually worked out okay.
Did you apply for a first officer job or it was for a captain?
Well, in my company, everyone begins as a first officer. And then based on seniority, you can ask to become a captain. But it is because it's seniority, it takes some time to percolate up to a position where something would be open, particularly if you want to live in certain bases or domiciles. So I live in San Diego. I'm domiciled in Los Angeles. If I wanted to be a captain in New York, I might be able to do it a little sooner, but not so much in Los Angeles. And a few months ago, I would have said it'll be a few more years. Now, with all the uncertainty, I don't know when, if ever, it will happen. But it's still, it's a good job, and I do enjoy it, and it has great privileges and perks, and it's frankly quite easy to do. I don't find it to be overly challenging.
Yeah, exactly. In my current company, we just have to wait something like 5 years, but I don't know in the US company how long you have to wait to go to the captain position, in average 5 to 10 years.
It's not necessarily due to age. The only restriction that I'm aware of is you have to have 1,000 flight hours of what we call Part 121 flying. And that's just the FAA regulation that governs the commercial flying in the United States. And so you can get 1,000 hours in a couple of years. I've already got that because they measure it differently than we do in the military. But it really comes down to your seniority in the company. So the day I started, I was junior to everybody who had started the day before me, but everyone who started after me, I'm senior to all of them. And so as more and more pilots retire, then you make your way up. But again, now with the uncertainty in the world and possibly reshuffling and resizing of the airlines, it's possible they could furlough, as it's called, the bottom so many hundreds or thousands maybe of pilots. And that simply means, hey, we don't need you right now. We're not firing you. But you can go do something else, grow a beard, whatever you want to do for a while. When it's time and we're looking for pilots, we will start with you before we'll hire someone else off the street. They did the same thing when the airlines were topsy-turvied after 9/11, 2001.
Yeah.
And so this is a repeat of that. And I've talked to some friends who've been through that, and they said, just see if you can survive, find something else to do. And then when they call you back, it should hopefully come back quickly and you'll be in good shape.
Do you continue to fly general aviation, being in the commercial aviation? Because personally, I just missed handling a lot. I can't right now because I'm in Asia and flying is not that easy, let's say, and affordable. But yeah, do you still fly aerobatics, GA, whatever?
You know, Matt, I really don't. And I've thought about this because I've been asked this before. And I, while I love flying, I like to have something to do when I'm flying. So I'm also a scuba diver, and I haven't scuba dived in a long time because unless I'm doing something specific, I've seen the rocks, I've seen the fish, and each time is different. I get it, but I just feel like there's nothing left to do scuba diving unless I'm going to go hunting, spearfishing, or explore a wreck or something. And for flying, I feel like after flying the F-18 for 3,200 flight hours, I did pretty much everything there is to do. I did not eject, which is fine. And I never shot anyone down, which is also fine. And so any other airplane is not going to be nearly as capable as an F-18. And I guess partly I don't feel a real drive. I know for some pilots, they'll raise their eyebrows at me on that one. But the other reason, truthfully, is that the nearest airport for me is a 20-minute drive. It could be more with traffic. And flying is not cheap. And I live in an expensive part of the country. And so I just try to manage my finances. I've got children who like to do other things. And my wife has other interests as well. So I don't actually. And sometimes I feel badly about it, but I guess if I felt too badly, I'd probably go find a way to do it. And it's okay. I feel like I've gotten my thrills.
So you've done a lot. You've flown the F-18, the F-16, now your commercial aviation. What's remaining on your aviation bucket list?
Well, I never had a chance to fly with one of the demonstration teams. And so that would be interesting. Although I'm fearful that now, having done very little flying, I'd probably get sick. So maybe I don't want to embarrass myself and go do that. But I very much love the outdoors. I love to fly fish. So maybe I don't necessarily need to be at the controls. But I've seen some really amazing videos of people who fly these small airplanes, Cubs and things, into very small, basically riverbanks in Alaska, let's say.
Yeah.
And so to go do something like that, I don't, again, need to be at the controls, but just to watch a pilot do that and put me down and let me go fish for 8 hours where few men have ever been, I think that would be on my bucket list. But truthfully, Matt, that's as much because I want to fish as it is because I want to fly.
Yeah, just don't tell me, please, Jello, that you want to become a weasel.
No. I mean, I have an appreciation for the backseaters and sideseaters, having done a little bit of that just because I've had to in various times when you're going somewhere. But I think there's absolutely a place and a need for those crew. But no, that's not something necessarily I aspire to, but not for any other reason that I just no interest in. But I'm also too old for the military at this point anyway.
Yeah, I'm kidding, of course. Do you plan to go back in the reserve?
No, in the States, when you retire from active duty, there's not a lot of opportunity for that. In fact, I don't know of any, and I don't know if that's just me not exploring it enough, but I've never heard of anyone who retires from active duty and then goes to the reserves. What you can do instead is you can separate from active duty, go to the reserves, and then at some point, maybe you have enough time that you can either retire or at least cut back, but that you could still do it at that point. So in the States, we have also Air National Guard bases at various locations. And some of those guys can stay there for decades and keep flying, mm-hmm. even though they're captains on 777s and doing other things, they can still go get their thrills. And so that is not an opportunity for me. But I will tell you this, Matt, there are more and more companies here in the States every day that are acquiring used military aircraft, including some of your old French jets, F1s and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so, and they are providing that at a fee to the United States Air Force. And they are always looking for pilots. And I think right now they're being inundated with resumes because of the uncertainty. But
yeah.
There's one particular company that is looking to buy some used Australian F-18s. And so I reached out to that company and I said, hey, I flew a lot of hours in that. So maybe that's something I would be interested in doing, but it's going to take years for them to get those aircraft ready. And maybe I can help in a strategic sense. But again, there's really not a lot. Even if I were to go to do that, I think it'd be interesting for a while. But then I don't know about you, Matt. My mindset is being a fighter pilot is a young man's or woman's sport. It's not so easy on your skeleton, your neck, your back. And so I'll be turning 50 this year, and I don't know how much more my body could take already. And it's been a couple of years since I've done it. So I think I'm satisfied.
What's next now for you?
Well, of course, there's some uncertainty with my profession as an airline pilot that we'll wait and see. And if I end up sitting on the bench for a little while, so be it. Otherwise, what's next for me is I have my own podcast, and it's called the Fighter Pilot Podcast. It's been going for a couple of years now. And I have a wonderful team of volunteers from all over the world who saw me launch my show and kind of felt almost sorry for me. You know how like you help a kid when his backpack is too heavy. I think they came along and said, oh, isn't that cute? Here, let's help you get a real website. Here, let's help you get real music and processing and production. And so we have a team of about a dozen people, and we have a lot of really exciting initiatives we are working on, including a website for our parent company, which is called BVR Productions. We'd like to maybe add more podcasts to our stable, kind of like ones like yours that are affiliated with military. In fact, my show has been such a success, and I don't take any credit for it. but it's got such a base of fans who love military aviation. I'm trying to look for someone like me out there who spent a career maybe in armor or tanks. And let's have a podcast about tanks, because I don't know of anyone who's doing it, but I know darn well there's a lot of movies that feature armor and tanks. And I bet you people would love to hear all about what it's like to drive those and fight those. And so if I could find the right person, we might want to help start a show about tanks.
Perhaps you would have a nice audience.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah. And so maybe there's an audience for submarines. There's a lot of movies about submarines. Maybe there's an audience for even surface warfare on ships, or of course there's already shows on special warfare, but maybe we could do different things. So we want to become a media company where we can help people who have an idea for a show come to us and say, hey, we're not going to ask you for money. It's not an investment of your wallet. It's an investment of your time. Mm-hmm. If you want to affiliate with us, here's what we think are the best practices. We'll help get you going. And maybe if you make a little money, great.
Yeah, you mentioned the BVR Pro company. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so as the Fighter Pilot podcast became more successful, we thought, well, let's see if we can brand this into something bigger. But the word podcast we felt was somewhat limiting because it implies an internet radio. And so we thought, well, what else would make sense for a parent organization? And so we came up with some different ideas, and we finally settled on BVR Productions, because you know as well as I do, Matt, in our world, BVR stands for Beyond Visual Range. And so Think of a missile, you launch it many, many miles. Well, you don't see the person launching it, but you get the little special package when it arrives if you're on the wrong end. And so we thought, well, isn't that clever? Because we have this show that we launch out like a missile and people receive it, and hopefully they receive it a little more happier. And so that's how we came up with that. And as a side note, now we're starting to have some partners, and we're looking at some different merchandise options. And we thought maybe just for fun, we will call that WVR Designs. Because again, as you know, Matt, when you get into a dogfight, that is within visual range, and so is a t-shirt. And so we have, like I said, a lot of interesting initiatives. I'm really excited to see where we go.
Well, Jello, thank you very much for coming here. The last question, as I always ask, is do you have any major lessons learned regarding your aviation and professional career?
Major lessons learned. I would say that you have to believe in your dreams and go for it. I receive emails and phone calls and different inquiries from people all the time that say, oh, I want to do this, but I'm not sure if I'll make it. And my answer to them is, well, what's the alternative? If you're sitting on the 13th floor of some office building someday and a jet goes flying by your window and you look out, do you want to know that you tried? Or do you want to say, I wonder what would have come of it? And so I tell young people who reach out to me, go for it. I think a career in the cloth of a nation's military is honorable, as it has been for many century or millennia. And certainly in military aviation, you can be around amazing people. You can have opportunities you can't pay to go do. Is there sacrifice? Absolutely. Is it hard? You bet. But I would say that if you've got a dream to do it, figure out what's involved, follow your dream. And even if you don't make it, maybe that's okay, because then you know that you've tried. And then with anything else, I would say to just be as clear-headed and sober, and I don't mean literally, but just think about things that are important to you and the things you want to do. So I reference back to my point of, I know I want to take care of my family, and I should credit my wife. She also works, and some years she makes as much or more than me. But the point being simply that I didn't want to not provide for my family, or at least add to it. And so you have to think about the things that are important and the people who rely on you, and make decisions that make sense. And once you do it, commit yourself to it. Even if for whatever reason, it's not really what you want to do, do it for a season and wait and see what happens. And maybe you can pivot to something else at that point to really do the things you want to do. But I would say whatever you're doing, do it with all your body, mind, spirit, all that.
Jello, thank you very much for coming on the 90s podcast. It was a pleasure having you here.
Oh, it was my honor to be here, Matt. You run a great show. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I'm trying to do it. And what's the phrase you say always at the last part of your episode? Let's get out of here.
I always say it. Let's get out of here. That's right. Let's do it.
Okay, let's get out of here. Cheers, man. Thanks.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the 90s podcast, an aviation podcast. Subscribe and share on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Deezer, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can as well follow us on Instagram on the 90s podcast account. Thanks for listening.